Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this class entitled Where is God in the Pain? This is part of our course, a course that we began last week called Wrestling with Faith. So this is, in fact, lesson number four. We were planning on doing lesson number two this week, but lesson four deals with the topic of tragedy, pain, suffering, loss, and where is God in the pain? And I felt that it's a very appropriate topic to study together this week and to invite the entire community out to join us in this study. So for those of you that are joining us, especially for tonight, I have prepared copies of the class so that you can follow along and we can all study together. I'm going to be sending down a handful of copies on this side of the room and then another handful on that side of the room. If you have a book, please keep it. Pass it back. If you don't have a book, please take one and pass it back. If we run out of copies, please share on with someone else. Okay, while these copies are going around, I want to mention that last week, in the context of our overall course, six-week course, Wrestling with Faith, I posed the question, what are the biggest challenges to faith? What are those things that prove to be, that provide to be the biggest challenges to someone's faith in God? I taught the class twice. I taught it Tuesday night, and I taught it Thursday afternoon. And the answer, the response that I consistently received, and those of you who were here last week can attest to this fact, the response that was given by many of you in this room is that the greatest challenge to our faith is in moments of loss, whether it's loss of a job, loss of a relationship, or loss of life. When there's loss, that evokes the greatest questions, the deepest questions, the questions that don't seem to go away. And if there's anything that rocks our faith, it's tragedy. It's suffering. When I asked that question last week and when we discussed this topic without exploring it in depth, little did we know that we were days away from the most horrific act of anti-Jewish violence in the history of the United States of America. In the aftermath of the horror, we are left grieving and we are left with questions on faith. And so the objective of this session is to allow us, all of us, to work through our pain, our grief, our disbelief, our fear, our questions, by exploring Judaism's highly personal teachings on the topic of tragedy and loss. This session is all about facilitating discussion and working towards healing. This class is divided into three acts. Act number one, the questions, validating our struggles and fears. Act two, the mysteries, Jewish wisdom on tragedy and loss. And act three, the response, rebuilding after tragedy. There's a lot to discuss. Let's begin. Act one, the questions, validating our struggles and fears. So I'd like to open up this as a discussion. I know there's a lot of people in the room, and if everyone spoke even for 60 seconds, we would be out of time. So we're going to try to do this in somewhat of a manner that we include a discussion, because that's what this is about. And at the same time, we're respectful of the time and the material that we have. So the question that I'd like to pose at the top is, if you think about your reaction to the news that you heard about what happened on Saturday, on Shabbat, in Pittsburgh, what is your reaction? What are your feelings about God or towards God from what happened? If anybody would like to share. Anger.
You question his existence.
Question his existence. Good.
He's the Almighty, the true judge.
Almighty, true judge. Is that letting him off the hook or putting him on the, holding his feet to the fire, so to speak?
Happened
What else?
This is what it is to be a Jew.
This is what it is. Destiny.
Unexplainable.
Unexplainable. Couldn't God have just made the gun jam or something? Right?
For me, it's less challenging in that this was not a plague, which we could have said, that's Hashem. This was a crazy.
So then is the question, where is God?
Not to me,
or it's an answer?
Yeah, that's the question. Why did Hashem stop me? He doesn't
right.
stop me.
Yeah. Say it again.
Maybe God decided he would let that he would deal with the right people, that they people who just got shot, the community, the Jewish community is going to now do something.
Yeah. A lot of different reactions, yeah.
I would say maybe he is disappointed, grieving.
God lets us figure it out, for better or for worse. Okay, let's begin. Everyone has a copy or a book, more or less? Yes, did they go to the back? Did they end up reaching the back? Thank you, Ed. Please open up your booklets or your book to exercise number one in the lesson. You can find it right at the beginning of the lesson, page number of the exercise is page 102. And so I'm gonna read these four statements, and I want to take a poll. Here's how we're gonna do it. You're gonna rank the four statements, you're gonna rank them from a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being strongly disagreeing with the statement, 5 being strongly agreeing with the statement. If you don't mind, we're gonna go through them one at a time. Just hold up your hand, either 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, whether you strongly disagree or you agree with the statement. 1, not agreeing. 5, very much agreeing. And then, of course, you have the middle. So, statement number 1. When we suffer tragedy, we seek to understand its cause and its meaning. Do you agree with that, or do you disagree with that, or do you agree with that? You're raising your hand on a scale of 1 to 5. With fingers, right? Hold up the number that you believe is a response. We have finger detection software that can quickly count up. We don't, actually. Okay, so I'm seeing a lot of fingers up. Doesn't sound right, but I see a lot of full hands up, and I'm thinking that a lot of you are strongly agreeing with this, that we seek to find meaning and the cause when tragedy happens. Okay, next statement. Struggling with faith in God due to suffering results from a lack of belief. Do you disagree with that, or do you agree with that? Please vote or state your position with your hands, with the number of fingers. Again, the statement is that when one struggles with faith in God, it means due to suffering, it means that they have a lack of belief. The struggle is a symptom of lack of belief when challenges happen. Do you disagree or do you agree with that? Okay, I'm seeing many less, for the most part. I'm seeing a lower number of fingers being held up. Okay, let's move on. When we suffer tragedy, we are prone to feelings of loneliness. Agree or disagree? Okay. I see mostly, we're back to lots of fingers per hand. Okay, next, the tragedies that we suffer often leave a scar. We never return to our previous selves. It leaves an indelible mark on us. Do you agree or disagree? Agree. Okay, again, a lot of full hands. Okay, I want to distill these four statements and talk about them, explore them, and really, what I think is, for the most part, most of us in this room by my very scientific polling methodology, most of us in this room are pretty much on the same page. You were all pretty much consistent with each other in your responses. In other words, let me rephrase these four statements. We wonder why tragedy struck. We wonder how God could allow such a thing to happen. We wonder, where is God? And we might feel scared, we might feel scarred, bruised, and pained. Those are the four statements. And so the first thing I'd like to do is to share with you that these are all normal human reactions that are 100% validated in Jewish thought. The first sentiment is seeking meaning. Why did God allow this to happen? Or what is the meaning behind this? Asking why after loss and tragedy is a very natural response of a moral and believing human being. In fact, far being an articulation of lack of faith, in fact, there's a profound letter that was penned by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which we're going to read in a moment. That's text 1 on page 103. In this letter, the Rebbe wrote to a woman after the Holocaust, a woman who expressed doubts about God following the Holocaust. Here is the letter that the Rebbe wrote, text number 1, page 103. What we usually do is we go around the room to read the reading. So I usually start on my left side, your right side. So we're going to start there again. Are you up to reading?
Sure.
Text 1, okay.
I don't believe your assertion that you don't believe in God. In fact, it is clear to me that even you don't believe it. The proof is, you write in your letter that upon perceiving in your world a lack of justice and fairness, and upon recalling the Holocaust caused by Hitler, may his name be erased, you are disturbed. Now, if there were no force conducting and planning world events, why is it surprising when injustice occurs and the big swallows the small? Note that this question of unfairness is not only regarding world-scale events like the Holocaust. Even regarding simple day-to-day occurrences, we are disturbed by any unfair event and expect things to be different. Now, the realms of the inanimate and the animal kingdom surely aren't expected to abide by the rules of justice. Who or what, then, do we expect to act justly? We must conclude that the uneasiness caused by these negative events must be due to an awareness of a force that's beyond the inanimate and animal realms, and even the human realm. The awareness of this force is found in the heart of every person. This is what gives rise to the wide-held conviction that justice ought to rule the world and that world events ought to be fair. Therefore, when something isn't right, we desperately seek the cause for this unnatural state of events.
I want to ask you to reflect on this. Thank you. I want to ask you to reflect on this excerpt from this letter that the Rebbe writes to this woman who says she can't believe in God after the Holocaust and other tragedies. So what is the Rebbe's central point in this letter? She's claiming she doesn't believe. And how is the Rebbe kind of flipping it back around? What's the Rebbe saying? The fact that she's bothered by injustice means that there's an expectation that there shouldn't be injustice. But why? In other words, the reason why it bothers us is because deep down we do believe. And because we believe, we know things shouldn't be like this. And because they shouldn't be like this, we rail against injustice. If there's no God, if there's no greater force, higher power, then what is the expectation that things should be just? What is the expectation that things should be good? And what's the definition of good at all? How do we define good? Who's to define good? So again, the point of this letter, the core idea here is the Rebbe is almost taking her own pain and illuminating that the pain is emanating from a place, in a sense, paradoxically, or maybe not paradoxically, of belief, of wanting to believe. The last paragraph is also very, very relevant. The Rebbe writes, therefore, when something isn't right, we desperately seek the cause for this unnatural state of events. When we hear tragedy, we all seek a reason. What happened? Why did it happen? What was this person doing? What were they thinking? We seek a cause because we think it to be unnatural. Because things should be good. That's our expectation. In God's world, things should be good. We believe in a good God. And so when they're not, we desperately seek the cause. So to ask the question, statement number one of the exercise that I rephrased, why, God, when tragedy happens and we look upwards and we say, why, God, that's a perfectly natural and normal human, moral, and spiritual response. The second statement is another question. And that statement is, how, God? This is, how could God allow such horror, in this instance, in his own house of worship? How could God have allowed this? Not why, God, but how. How could God have allowed this? This question, once again, we're validating our natural responses and the questions that we ask, validating it based on traditional Jewish teachings. This is not, in the Jewish understanding, this is not heresy. It's not, you know, how dare a person question God. To question God's sense of justice or to call something out as injustice is a very Jewish idea. In fact, when you look through Scripture, when you look through the Torah, you find again and again the greatest of the greats challenging God. We just had this past Shabbat. As this horror went down in Pittsburgh, around the world, synagogues were reading about a story of Abraham and Sarah and the angels that came to visit them. And God telling Abraham, FYI, you probably should know, since we're tight, I probably should tell you so you don't read it on CNN. I should probably tell you beforehand that I'm about to destroy this city of Sodom and its surrounding cities, five cities in total. And what does Abraham do upon hearing those words? Abraham immediately springs into action. And he begins advocating for the cities. He says, well, God, hear me out. If there are 50 righteous people, a minion, 10 per city, five cities times 10, right? You do the math. So if there's 50 tzaddikim amongst these 10 cities, 50 righteous people, would you spare the cities? God said, yeah, but we don't have it. The numbers aren't there. All right, how about, and he negotiates down, 40, 30, 20, 10, not even 10, not even one minion, not even one city that could be spared. But as Abraham is launching into his challenge, his advocacy for the cities, Abraham says the following, text number 2, truly, 105.
Thereby making the righteous and wicked equal. It is unthinkable for you. Will the judge of the entire world not do what is just?
Abraham thunders to God. How could you take the innocent with the guilty? Will the judge of the entire world not do what is just? How would you characterize the statement?
Bold.
What's a good Yiddish word that we might use? Chutzpah. I'm just letting you all exercise your inner right? Chutzpah. It's a little brazen, right? He throws a rhetorical question. Huh? Yeah. It's a rhetorical question. It's like, well, the judge, I mean, you claim to be the ultimate judge and the absolute in fairness. Really? You're going to do this? Moses, after the sin of the golden calf, he says, your desire to destroy the Jewish people is not right. In fact, Moses says, famously in chapter 32, verse 32 of Exodus, Lamed Beis, Lev, the heart of Exodus, Moses says to God the following. He says, forgive the Jewish people, v'im ayin, and if not, mechenina misivracha asher kasafta, erase me from your book, i.e. Torah, that you have written. Take me out. I don't want to have any part of this book that does not act fairly and does not allow for forgiveness. The greatest of the great challenged God. When they felt that something wasn't right, they didn't say, well, it's God's will. Sodom has to go. Sodom has to go. All right. Listen, there's other cities. Whatever. We can move on. Moses didn't say, well, the Jewish people, they did sin. We've all seen the movie, Ten Commandments, right? Charlton Heston right there with the tablets. Pretty sure that's how it happened. Literally, it went down, right? Those who will not live by the word shall die. Right, that whole thing, that whole dramatic scene. Smash the tablets. Moses could have said, well, they're guilty. You know, what are you going to do? I go on the mountaintop. The next thing you know, they're doing the Hava Nagila, the Hora around the golden calf. That's it. Moses says, hey, I'll start the Jewish people again with you. You'll be like, you'll be the new Abraham. And Moses says, no, that's not okay. Abraham challenges God. Moses challenges God. Job challenges God. David challenges God. All of the greats challenge God. So a natural and normal response, a human, moral response to the horrors that we've seen, to the other tragedies and losses in our lives, a natural reaction is, how could God have allowed this to happen? Is that heresy? Does it mean that one doesn't believe in God? Of course not. And according to Jewish sources, it's a question that we ought to ask. The third statement, the third question in our list of statements. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
So the people that you've named who have this relationship with God, and they were, I feel like they were allowed to ask because they had divine presence. And so I feel like you can question if they we all can question we're human, but I feel like we said, like, so you have divine presence, you can ask, why are you doing this? Why is this happening?
I would agree with you with this point. I think the closer of a relationship one has with God, the more they'll question. It's not the other way around. If God is a theory, then theoretically God probably couldn't have stopped it anyway, right? If God is only a theory. If God is real, if you really believe in God, you really, really, really know and feel that relationship, then you ask a question. Why did you hurt me? Why did this happen? How did this happen? How did you allow this to happen? So I agree with you at that point. Abraham, Moses, Job, David, they had close relationships and they felt it. And they couldn't hold themselves back. But I don't believe that just because God doesn't speak to us, we can't speak to him. And I don't, no, I'm not saying that you said that. I'm just.
I totally agree, but if you're getting an answer back, then it's like, of course I'm going to ask why or how,
right.
If I'm going to be able to get a response and say, well, this is what this city is doing, this is what this people aren't doing.
You know what they say, if you pray to God, if you speak to God, You're pious. If God speaks to you, you're meshuggah. That's what they say. So I've been told. God told me that. Joking. Come on. I hear your point. We certainly have a different relationship. Nonetheless, as feeling human beings and human beings that are working on a relationship with God, I think it behooves us. It's not taboo, this question. It behooves us to ask this question. How could God have allowed this to happen? The third point is, where is God? Which is a sense of abandonment. That God was not there or was not here when we needed him most. King David speaks at length about feelings of abandonment, feeling abandoned by God. There's even a verse in the five books in Deuteronomy, Devarim, that speaks to this, page 106, text 3.
Haven't these disasters happened to me because my God isn't with me?
Isn't that a human reaction, right? That what these disasters happened to me because God is not with me. You've been probably noticing a lot of rhetorical questions here, and then you ask why Jews ask rhetorical questions. See what I did there? I'm modeling this lesson. Okay, so. Asking where is God, feeling that God was not with us, was not there when we needed him most, again, is a very natural and a Jewish response. It's right there in the Torah as well. The final point was the idea of it hurting, there being pain. Feeling pain and suffering amidst loss and tragedy is also normal. The prophet Jonah expresses his pain to God following loss. Job endures pain and suffering. The point is that all of these emotions and questions, why God, how God, where is God, and the feeling of pain, they're all validated in Jewish thought, which means that it's okay for you and I to have these strong questions and these strong feelings in the aftermath of pain, loss, and tragedy. So that's point number one. And that is act number one. Why God, how God, where's God, and it hurts. Any questions so far? Okay. Act two. The mysteries, Jewish wisdom on tragedy and loss. So in truth, we can't answer these unfathomable questions. We can't answer these questions that are almost themselves bigger than answers. But we can learn a perspective, a Jewish perspective on pain and loss. And as we'll see throughout this lesson, this can be profoundly helpful in its own right. We're going to start a discussion of the Jewish perspective, Jewish wisdom on tragedy and loss. We're going to begin with Moses. Moses's origin story is very well known. Moses, of course, was born in Egypt to Jewish parents amidst the terrible conditions of Egyptian slavery. There was a decree then that the Torah, the Bible, tells us about, that boys that were born were to be cast into the sea and killed. Moses was born early, and when his mother could not hide him anymore, his mother placed him in a basket, the forerunner of the Moses basket, and placed him on the Nile River. Waterproofed it and placed it on the Nile River. Moses was in danger, and a young woman sees a baby in a basket floating down the Nile River, and she extends her hand. In fact, our sages tell us that it was a miracle what happened. The basket, the baby, was very far away. She extended her arm, and her arm miraculously extended to be able to collect the basket with the child. By the way, there's a commentary that asked the question, if it was so far away, why did she even reach out her hand? Right? Logically. Her hand, she reached out and it was extended, but if it was really too far away, why even try? It's a message in life. Sometimes you don't think you can attain certain goals. Try. You never know what can happen, and God can help. That's a sidebar. So Moses is collected. He's rescued by this young woman, who is none other than, as irony would have it, none other than Batya, the daughter of Pharaoh. And she raises him like a son. He grows up in the royal palace. The Torah then continues, cuts to Moses' young adulthood, and it says that he was walking out one day to see his Jewish brethren. And there he sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating, severely beating, a Jewish slave, a Jewish man. Moses, the Torah tells us, looked this way, and he looked that way. He struck the Egyptian in defense of this fellow who the Egyptian was beating to death. He struck the Egyptian perished, and he buried him under the sand. Well, the story continues. The news leaked to Pharaoh. Pharaoh found out that Moses, his own adopted grandson, so to speak, right? Moses had killed an Egyptian protecting a Jew. Well, that was not okay. And so now Moses is he's a marked man. And so the story is that he runs away from Egypt. And he ends up in a place called Midian. And in Midian, he meets a young woman, Zipporah. They get married, and he works as a shepherd, taking care of his father-in-law's flock. The story continues. This is all beginning of Exodus. I think I'll go all the way through the end of Deuteronomy, if you don't mind joking. We're about to get to the major idea. So Moses one day is shepherding his flock, doing the thing that shepherds do, right? And he walks by the most wondrous sight. There's a bush that's burning. It's on fire, but it's not being consumed. They tell a story about George Bush, who lands in Ben-Gurion Airport, lands in Israel. And he sees Moses. He's biblical Moses, not Moses somebody. No, he sees Moses himself, the original Moses with the staff, the whole garb. And he says, Moses, it's me. He ignores him. He says, Moses, it's me. Ignores him again. He gets up right into his face. Moses, it's me. So Moses says, last time I spoke to a bush, I got taxed with this huge deal and we got stuck in the desert for 40 years. Not again. Not again. Anyway, Moses sees this wondrous sight. He sees a bush that's on fire, but the bush is not being consumed by the fire. And then suddenly, the voice of God appears to him. He hears the voice of God. And God calls upon Moses at that moment to be the one to take out, to be the human representative, to take out the Jewish people from Egyptian slavery and to redeem them from bondage. There's a long dialogue that ensues. Moses is very hesitant to take on the job. Like any true great leader, a truly great leader is not looking for positions of leadership. Leadership, at least in the Jewish understanding, in Jewish history, the greatest Jewish leaders were always those who were prevailed upon to be leaders, not ones who ran after leadership. I am not announcing tonight running for... No. So Moses is very, very hesitant. This is the dialogue that ensues. Text number 4. Marcia. Page 107.
God said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cries of distress because of their slave drivers, for I am aware of their suffering. I have come down to rescue them from the hands of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, I hope I'm saying this right,
yeah,
the Perizzites,
present,
the Hivitites, I always get the hard word, and the Jebusites.
Jebusites, yeah.
Whatever.
It's all right.
Okay.
You'll know him when you see him. That's
okay.
Continue, please.
And now the cry of the children of Israel had come to me, and I have also seen how the Egyptians are oppressing them. Now go, I will send you to Pharaoh, and you will take my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to the Pharaoh and that I should take the children of Israel out of Egypt? He replied, for I will be with you, and this will be your sign that I send to you, that when you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain. Moses said to God, I will come to the children of Israel, and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they will say to me, what is his name? What shall I respond to them? God said to Moses,
Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh.
Thank you. I will be what I will be. And he said, say the following to the children of Israel.
Ehyeh.
I will be has sent me to you.
Thank you. So we have here the dialogue, the beginning of the dialogue. It's so the narration continues and Moses, still not convinced, but let's analyze these two statements. So Moses, his first attempt to defer is, he says, who am I? You got the wrong guy. I'm a shepherd. I'm not a leader type. I'm not, that's not my profile. Who am I to go? So God says, listen, don't worry about it. I'll be with you. I'll go with you. You're not going alone. You don't need to be. I will be your strength, etc. Okay, what's Moses' second pushback? What does he say? What's the second issue? It's a little bit more nuanced, right? When I come to the Jewish people, they're going to ask me, what's your name? And I don't know what to tell them, so I can't do it. So God's like, don't worry about it. Here's my name, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. I will be what I will be, and just tell them I will be has sent me to you, me meaning Moses, to you, the Jewish people. Okay, does that make sense?
No.
Yes? Sort of? To me, it doesn't make any sense. Number one, Moses is working on a very, very tenuous assumption here. There's a very, you can argue with this assumption. Imagine, Moses strolls in to the Jewish neighborhood. He offers bagels and cream cheese and lox, gets a crowd, and then he says the following. I'm just saying, we like our bagels. I have an idea to get people off the Beltline to services. With a bagel. Or get filter fish.
No.
You guys,
the more food, the better.
You know how good filter fish is, right? There's Lake Gefilte. You take a jar and you just scoop them out. It's easy because they're in the jelly anyway. They can't move. You just. All right. Gefilte fish jokes. Didn't see that coming here. All right. So Moses' assumption is that when he comes to God, to the Jewish people, and he says, hey guys, you'll never guess who I spoke to. It's God, and I'm coming to deliver you, etc. So the first thing they're going to say is not, that's awesome, when are we out of here, how's this going to go down? No, the first question is, what's the name of God? Who is this God that's, what's his name? I want to ask you the question. Do you think that's the first thing the Jews are going to say? What do they want, a business card? They'd be like, wait a second, I don't know that we're talking about the same God. Who's your God? What's his name? What's, is that what they're asking? What do they want, like a LinkedIn page? What?
His essence?
His essence, maybe, I don't know. But Moses is operating under a strange assumption that when he approaches the Jewish people, they're obviously going to ask him first thing, what's your name? And he's not going to have an answer, so he can't do it. Right? That, again, the assumption, the premise of Moses' pushback is a little bit strange. Do we agree with this? Help me out. Say, yeah.
Is it not authentication?
He could be, but like, is that the first thing they're going to ask?
I think they want to authenticate whether he is really speaking for God.
Right.
They're desperate.
But then why doesn't Moses just tell them who? So what? But Moses, you would think, knows kind of his people. He wasn't that isolated. He would, He didn't only walk like an Egyptian. He also knew how the Jew crew was going on. So, look, he could have done some intel, found out, you know, like the name. It seems like that might not be the only reason. And the second question is, what was God's answer? Very strange name. What's his answer? Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, I will be what I will be. Since when is that a name of God? I know a lot of names of God in Scripture. That's not one of them. That's a made-up name. I'm not calling out God. But that's a new name. That's like brand new. It's like Elohim and Hashem, the four-letter name of God, all that stuff. Like, if you have names of God in the first, like, book and a little bit of the Torah, in the first whatever chapters, you got a few names of God, and suddenly, when Moses is asking to authenticate, even if it's, let's say, authentication, so God says, well, try this new name on, and this will really catch him by surprise. This doesn't even make sense. God should have recalled the name that the Jewish people would have known, which then kind of undoes that theory that it was authentication, because he's giving them a new name. He's giving Moses a new name. Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, I will be what I will be. What? It's very vague. It's baffling, and it's not one of the names of Scripture, of in Scripture of God. Okay, you with me on the questions? Why is Moses asking the question? Doesn't seem to be a relevant question at this juncture. It doesn't seem to be like the most important question to ask right now. And number two, what is the nature of God's response here?
I'm sure that you forgot to learn this when you went to Yeshua, but when we were in Egypt, we didn't have the Torah yet, so we didn't have any names to call God.
However.
I know, however.
However, there's always a however. On the other hand, there's so many different hands. On the other hand, the Jews had a tradition. Had a tradition passed down from Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob about who and what God was. And there was a tradition that there would be a time when they would leave Egypt and that God would save them. And they referred to God with a name. They certainly referred to God with some sort of name. So, huh?
Do we know the name?
I'm not at liberty to share it tonight. Are you Moses? Are you asking me for the name of God? All right. Here's... Yeah, the names are the names, probably the ones that were used in Scripture. Either the what's known as a tetragrammaton, no relation to Tetris. It's the four-letter name of God, the Yud, followed by the He, followed by the Vav. So it's called the Ineffable Name. It's a name that we don't even pronounce the way it's written. Even in the prayers, we pronounce it with a different, totally different letters. We don't even pronounce those letters. So that would be the classic name of God, or Elohim, which is not either written that way. It's written with a He instead of what I'm replacing with a Kuf, whatever. Elohim, which is another name of God. One of those two were likely the names of God that were.
Nonetheless, it's not
we know,
a.
It was not this one. It was not this one.
It's not this name.
Right. Right. And when Moses comes to Pharaoh and says, God told me, let my people go, the famous call, let my people go, God said, he refers to God with a name, with one of the Jewish names. See, he knew the name of God, and he didn't even use that name to Pharaoh. So something's not, there's another explanation here, another element here that's beneath the surface.
So could it not be that probably word got around, folks kind of knew who Moses is or was it maybe not a test of Moses' authenticity? Okay, so who is it you're representing?
Right.
I mean, are you representing the Egyptian princess that
okay.
put you in the palace?
Right.
That kept you separate from
it's
us?
It's a setup,
and
yeah.
there were some other stories along behavior was called into question by this fellow Jews. And so maybe it's an authentication of Moses. Who are you really? Who are you really serving? What is the name of the God that you are here purporting to serve?
I hear that. Again, the question is if he comes back with an Ehia name,
well, yeah.
that's like that's not even that's fake news. So it's not, but it could sound like it to the Jewish people who have never heard of that name. It wouldn't be an authenticating name. So let me share with you. I want to share with you. By the way, the answers that you're giving are actually answers that some of the commentators do cite. But there are questions on those. The questions that I came back with to all these responses are questions that are asked on these other commentaries. I want to share with you an insight, which I find to be incredible and very moving, an insight that was shared by the Lubavitcher Rebbe on January 8th, 1983. It was a Saturday. January 8th, 1983. And let's read this inside together. Well, we'll read it and we'll look at it together. This is text number 5, page 109. Hal, if you're up to it.
This was Moses' question. I will come to the children of Israel and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. This will undoubtedly elicit the question, what is his name? The Jews will immediately ask, what kind of name, that is behavior, is this to allow a terrible exile to endure for so many years and after thousands upon thousands of Jewish children have been murdered? That's when we are told that I have heard their cry, I will descend to rescue them. Moses adds and emphasizes that he himself has this question and protests too. What shall I tell them?
Before we turn the page, is it clear what the Rebbe is saying? He's saying, when I come to the Jewish people and I tell them, God told me it's time to take you out, they're going to say, What kind of God allowed this in the first place? What kind of God would allow for a people to be tortured, to be enslaved, families separated, children murdered by the thousands? What kind of God would allow this to happen? Who is this God? What's his name? Who does this? Suddenly now he's coming to save us. Suddenly now he hears our cries. Suddenly now? Where was he until now? Where was God until now? What kind of God does this? What is God's name? Moses tells God that if he comes to the Jewish people and tells them, hey, it's all going to come to an end. God loves you. He's taking you out. What's the first thing they're going to say?
Where have you been?
Now? Where have you been until now? Where have you been until now? Is that a relevant question that you think the people might ask? Does that make more sense than just, what's his name? And so now we need to know the answer. So what's God's response? God, let's recall the response. Text 6a, Sindri.
God said to Moses, Eye asher eye, I will be what I will be. And he said, say the following to the children of Israel, Eye, I will be as sent me to you.
So that's just a restatement of God's answer. Text 6b, please, Sindri, one more. Text 6b, this is Rashi's commentary explaining what God means when he says, I will be.
I will be with them in this trouble, but I will be with them in their subjugation by other kingdoms.
Rashi explains, and as the Rebbe will continue to explain in text number 7, in a moment, which we'll read in a moment, God is telling Moses, you don't think I was with them in their suffering? You think I just showed up? I've been with them this entire time. Text number 7.
Then this was the meaning of God's response. I will be what I will be, as understood by Rashi. I will be with them in both this hardship and in future hardships. God hadn't ignored the suffering of the Jewish people in their bitter exile. Heaven forbid. On the contrary, I will be with them in this hardship. God is together with the Jewish people in this hardship. That doesn't only mean that God is found in their presence. Rather, he is found in their pain. As the prophet says, whenever they are in pain, he too is in pain. When the Jewish people suffer, this, so to speak, causes God to suffer too.
In other words, God's response is, even if you cannot fathom it, even if you didn't see it, God says, know this and tell this to my people. Ehye asher ehye. I have been with them and I will be with them. I am with you in your pain. I am with you in your suffering. I am with you in your questions. I am with you in your darkest moments. When the darkness is at its worst, God says, I am there too. King David powerfully speaks of this in Psalms. Psalm 23, which we read before altogether. Let's read it one more time, or at least a section of it. Psalm 23, King David evokes this very same sentiment. Yeah, text 8.
The Song of David. God is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He lays me down in green pastures. He leads me beside peaceful waters. He restores my energy. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no harm, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me.
King David is talking about, he's referring to walking in the valley of the shadow of death. And he says, nonetheless, I will fear no harm, for you are with me. He does not say that there will be no harm. He says he will fear no harm. He's not saying that there won't be any harm. He's saying that harm, that hardship, he will not fear, and it will not break him, because he knows that in those darkest of moments, His faith tells him, tells King David, that God is with him. This is God's response to Moses. Moses says, the people are going to ask me, where have you been? And God says, where have I been? I've been in the same pain that my people have been in. And you may ask the question, so why didn't he stop it? And for that, we have the next section to talk about. But understand this first point. Where is God? God's own answer in the Torah is, God says, Ehyeh asher ehyeh, I am with you in the pain and in the suffering. Jay Litvin, Mr. Jay Litvin, was a remarkable human being. He grew up in Chicago. He did not grow up as a religious Jew, but he began to study. He began to discover the amazing relevance of Judaism to his life, and he embraced and practiced Judaism in a very beautiful way. In the early 1990s, he moved to Israel to head up a new initiative that was called, it's a Chabad program that still goes on today, Children of Chernobyl. The project, the program was to airlift children from Chernobyl and bring them to the Holy Land, to safety. At a later point, he established and he ran another organization in Israel, Chabad's Terror Victims Project, which helps support victims of terror in the Holy Land. Very, very special human being, an incredibly gifted writer, an incredibly emotive writer. He wrote from the heart. In 2000, he was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He battled for 4 years, but in 2004, he passed away. As an aside, one of his sons, Yaakov Litvin, lives in Atlanta, lives in Sandy Springs. His father, Yaakov's father, is Jay. Jay wrote many articles before he got sick. He continued to write to the very end. Let's read text number 9, page 113. This is from an article that he wrote that he titled From Under the Covers. He wrote extensively. A lot of his writings were published in Chabad, on Chabad.org on the website. This is an excerpt from this article.
During this time of my illness, I have sought to connect what is happening in my life within the context of my religious observance and my personal relationship with God. From the intensity of my current condition, I find myself in a surprisingly intimate and direct alliance with the Almighty, though in a way I would not have predicted. Beneath it all, there is this quiet awareness of God. There is the foundation of his presence. There is a silent recognition that I can always call home when I need to, and that someone will show up if it's raining too hard and I've forgotten my umbrella. God is not asking me to place him out there somewhere and talk to him, pray and meditate on his glory and his kingdom. Instead, during this time, he has come with the incredible opportunity to find him in every detail of the daily challenge before me. No, God has not left me in the dark. He sits in a chair at my bedside watching over me. And rather than needing to call out in my moments of fear, I simply need to slip my hand from under the covers, to reach out and take his hand in mine for only the moment it takes to reassure me of his presence.
I think those words speak for themselves and how he felt even in the darkest of moments in his greatest pain. Our faith tells us, Jewish faith tells us, that we are not alone in our pain. God is with us. God is in the pain. God is metaphorically shedding tears too. And knowing that, might just alleviate or help somewhat alleviate some of our suffering. Which, of course, leads to the big question that I mentioned before. If God is with us, then how does he allow this to happen? It's one thing to say, one could have said perhaps, that God is not around, God is not here, God doesn't know. But if we believe that God is, yeah, if you want maybe to close the doors, it sounds like we got some action going on back there. If we believe that God is with us in our darkest moments, in the tragedy, in the pain, in the suffering, then how could God actually do this to us or allow this to happen? How could this happen? And of all of the unanswerable questions or unfathomable questions, this is probably the ultimate. But what we can come to recognize is the following. Some things in life, by their own nature, by their own definition, simply cannot be known, especially by human beings who only see a very small piece of the puzzle of life. I want to share with you, let's read together a text number 10 from Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. He's a great thinker and a great rabbinic leader of the last century, of the 20th century. Text number 10.
Evil is a fact that cannot be denied. There is evil in the world. There are suffering and agony and death pangs. He who would deceive himself by ignoring the split in existence and by romanticizing life is but a fool and a fabricator of illusions. It is impossible to conquer monstrous evil with philosophical speculative thought. Certainly the testimony of the Torah regarding creation, that it is very good, is true. However, this is only stated from the unbounded perspective of the Creator. In man's finite, limited view, the absolute good in creation is not apparent. The contrast is striking and undeniable. To what might this situation be compared? To a person who views a beautiful tapestry, the work of a fine artisan, which contains woven into it on its front a representation dazzling to the eye. To our great sorrow, we see this image, in other words, the world, from the obverse side. Can such a sight become sublime, a sublime aesthetic experience? Thus we are incapable of comprehending the panorama of reality without which one cannot uncover God's master plan, the essence of the works of the Holy One.
So in this text, I think we have to be clear on what it says and what it doesn't say. This does not justify, or this does not excuse, or this does not explain pain, suffering, tragedy, and loss. What it does say is that we human beings are simply not capable of seeing a bigger picture. And when I say a bigger picture, meaning the grand, the totality of the picture of existence. And therefore, there are certain things by definition that we will never be able to understand. And recognizing that is not an act of giving up, but it's rather an act of acknowledgement of who we are. The more you know yourself, the more you know, at the same time, your limitations. It's when we don't know self that we think that we extend perhaps forever. When we have a bigger picture of self, we know where we begin and where we end and what we can fathom and what is simply unfathomable. So Judaism teaches us, Exodus, the story, the book of Exodus teaches us, the dialogue between Moses and God at the burning bush teaches us that God, in his own words, God says, I am with you in your pain. I am with you in your suffering. I am with you in your tears. Why don't you stop it, O God, we ask? We can't know that answer. We don't know that answer. And it's the most honest thing we can say. The most honest thing we can say is, we don't know. For anyone to give a reason is almost to minimize the pain and the suffering that happened. Elie Wiesel once spoke to a group of high school students about his experiences in the Holocaust. And a high school student asked him the following question. He said, where was God during the Holocaust? And Wiesel responded, if I gave you a good answer, would you sleep better at night? Are you seeking an answer that ties everything up with a ribbon, puts a bow on it, and now it makes sense? We don't really and honestly seek that. Because if we sought that, and if we got that, we would be less human. We would be less feeling. We would be less compassionate. We would be less empathetic. If we could explain away tragedy and explain the reasons for loss, if we could explain it away, it wouldn't hurt. And that would make us a little bit less human. When I say human, I mean a little bit less feeling, empathetic, sympathetic, etc. And so Judaism reminds us that it's okay to stay with the question. It's okay to know that God is with us, that God is always with us in our pain. And when we ask the question, so why didn't God stop it? Why doesn't God alleviate the pain? To that we say that there's only so much we can know, and this is not of that sort. This is not in the category of things that we can know. We look at the world from the other side of the tapestry. We see a mess. We see a mess of threads and yarn. I don't know what tapestries are made of, right? Whatever. Threads, material. We see a mess. We see knots and loose ends and frayed sides. That's what we see. We don't see the picture. We can't see the picture. Does this help us? Does this make it feel better? It doesn't. But I don't think it's meant to. The goal is not to feel better. The goal is to have a more accurate understanding of what it is, and to feel the pain when we need to feel the pain, and to feel the comfort when we need to feel the comfort, but never to answer the question and explain away evil and darkness. And so we have text 11.
Just
that's,
a quick question.
Yeah.
So I hear what you're saying, and I feel that way myself, that there are just, there really are some unknowable things. We don't see the whole picture, we're not going. But I feel like that is the excuse that many who say there is no God would say, this is what religious people say. When they don't have a good answer for you, they say, you can't know this. This is unknowable.
Right.
And so I just wonder...
To that challenge as well, I would say,
you
can't know that. You would say to that person. I understand the question.
This person is my brother. So
all right. I understand the question. I think for that, we can go back to the opening idea. What the Rebbe wrote in the letter to the woman who says, because of the Holocaust, I can't believe in God anymore because it bothers me so much. If you're bothered by evil, that being bothered by it subtly, at least the way it can be looked at from the vantage point of faith, indicates that there's an expectation of justice. There's an expectation of goodness. But why? Perhaps that's predicated on an underlying sense of order. Why a sense of order in a world of chaos? Why a sense of order? Why is it that we talk about a hurricane using words of devastation and loss and in negative terminology? Why is it not just, it is what it is? That's the way the world works. It's not. Why is it a tragedy? Why is it a tragedy when a natural disaster hits and many lives are lost? Why do we all call it a tragedy? Why is it a tragedy? It's nature. Why tragedy? We label it based on what we know to be true, and that is things should be better. And when they're not, we can ask. We've been validated in the questions. We can ask, and we can turn to God and say, we don't understand. For us, I think it's important to know that there are certain things that we won't understand. And to be able to embrace that, not to accept that and give up and go home, but to accept that on a more sophisticated level and say, there's a limit to what can be known. And this is where I'm hitting to that limit. I don't know if that helps, but that's something. Let's hold the questions till there's still one more section. We're still in part two, toward the end of part two, act two. We still have one more piece to cover, and I want to be mindful and respectful of everyone's time. Text 11. Mark, please read text 11 on the theme of recognizing that we may not have the answers to the questions that we ask.
God, you are always right when I contend with you, yet I will still argue with you. Why does the way of the wicked prosper and all who deal with treachery enjoy tranquility?
Why is it that this person was successful in his murderous intent? Why did God allow him to be successful? Why? And so Jeremiah says, God, I know you're always right and you always have your answers and I can't understand it and I shouldn't even try anymore, but I will always ask the question. I will never stop asking the question, predicated on an innate belief that what's right, what's good, should always transpire. This takes us to Act 3, which is the response, rebuilding after tragedy. After all is said and done, we still yearn to know why. Why did this happen? Why the pain? Why the loss? Why the tragedy? The question is real. It's visceral. It demands a response. Here's, for example, King David. I mentioned this before. King David asked why. But here is the actual text of King David asking why. Text 12a, Psalm 22. Sorry. Kaylee, Kaylee, lama azavtani, my God, why have you forsaken me? A most incredibly daring interpretation is offered by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, 12b. Please continue, sir.
Instead of reading the word lama, meaning for what reason, read the word as lama, meaning for what purpose.
So basically, in Hebrew, you can put a different emphasis on a different syllable. Okay? You saw what I did there? You heard what I did there? It's all about emphasis and syllables and how you pronounce things. So in Hebrew, you can say lama. Lama means why. What's the reason? And lama means for what purpose. Two slightly different. One is seeking a reason, one is seeking a purpose. It's different. It's actually the opposite. Lama azavtani means why did this happen? Lama azavtani means what am I going to do about it? What is the purpose of this act? What is the purpose of this thing that happened, this tragedy that happened? Who answers that question? You and I answer that question. The answer to the question, why did this happen? Only God can answer that. And as far as I've heard, he's not telling us. But the question of lama azavtani, for what purpose is this? You and I can create that answer by virtue of how we respond to what happened. Does that make sense? Yes? Take a look at text 13, a most beautiful text. Want to pass? I'll read it. Text 13, page 119. According to this is from Rabbi Soloveitchik again. According to Judaism, man's mission in this world is to turn fate into destiny, an existence that is passive and influenced into an existence that is active and influential, an existence of compulsion, perplexity, and speechlessness into an existence full of will, vision, and initiative. Destiny bestows on man a new status in God's world. It bestows upon man a royal crown, and thus he becomes God's partner in the work of creation. The question of questions is, what does suffering obligate man to do? This problem was important to Judaism, which placed it at the center of its worldview. I translated that. We do not wonder about the ineffable ways of the Holy One, but instead ponder the paths man must take when evil leaps up at him. We ask not about the reason for evil and its purpose, but rather about its rectification and uplifting. How should a man react in a time of distress? What should a person do so as not to rot in his affliction? The question is not so much why, but the question is now what? What do we do now? And based on how we answer that question, which is determined by our actions forward, that will give some sort of inflection. That will give some sort of meaning. That will give some sort of fate. Sorry, some sort of destiny to what we experienced. a natural reaction to tragedy, like the tragedy that we saw this past weekend, a natural reaction is to ask, why did this happen? But less important than seeking a reason for what already happened, for why what already happened happened. I said less important. For you and I, what's most relevant for us is to ask the question, what will I do because of it? Lama azavtani. For what? What is its purpose? What purpose can I, in a sense, can I move into from this episode, from this terrible tragedy? We cannot control fate. We cannot control what happens. No human being can. We try. In life, we try. And inevitably, we're awakened to the reality that we cannot control what happens to us. We don't choose pain. We don't choose suffering. We don't choose tragedy. We don't choose loss. It chooses us. We cannot control fate. But what we are in control of is our destiny, in the sense that we control how we react to the darkness. And as Judaism teaches, there's only one valid and justified response to the horror and the loss and the darkness. And this has always been the Jewish response. It's never been to move to a place of greater darkness and greater evil, God forbid, and greater horror, etc. It's never been that. The only valid and justified response to the darkness is for you and I to burst forth with an even greater light. Each of us, by virtue of our basic humanity and our divinity, the divine soul within us, is called upon to respond to the pain and the darkness by creating light, a more powerful light than the world has ever seen. So in the end, there are no answers. There are only responses. There are so many more questions than we could ever explain away. The questions, it's not a matter of quantity, it's also quality. The questions are simply too fierce to provide answers. No, we're not meant to provide the answers for pain and suffering and tragedy. What we're meant to do is provide a response, a clear and definitive response of goodness and light. If we today feel this pain so acutely, we must transform it into a catalyst to change the world for good. It's true individually and it's true collectively. And so I'd like to share with you some practical suggestions. Judaism contains three pillars: Torah study, prayer, and acts of good deeds, usually associated with tzedakah, giving charity. And so I'd like to encourage you, in response to this horrific act that happened in Squirrel Hill, in Pittsburgh, Shabbat morning, in response to this terrible act of darkness, extinguishing 11 beautiful flames who were gathered together in synagogue to pray to their Creator. In response to this, not to answer the question of why, but to answer the question, now what, for us, let each of us take on a resolution tonight. One resolution, either to add one more hour of Torah study, or to add one more service of prayer at a synagogue, group prayer, or an additional amount of tzedakah, of charity. This is the way, this is a way in which you and I can transform the darkness, at least in our own area, the darkness, into light. We put out before the class index cards. And most of you have pens. If you don't, there are pens up here, more index cards. I encourage you, to take on a commitment and to write it down. There's power in writing it down. There's power in verbalizing it. There's power in writing it down. Write it down. Write it down and take it home with you. Take it home with you and put it on the fridge. I know the nice fridges now, they don't have they're not magnetic. But there's always the side of the fridge. That's what they don't tell you. The sides are still magnetic. I know. That's where I put all my kids' stuff up. So take home an index card. In the inspiration, hopefully inspiration of this class, commit to something, an extra hour of Torah study, another prayer service at a synagogue, or a little bit more tzedakah. The sooner the better to deliver on these, because if we push it off, we might forget. Write it down, take it home, commit to be fierce in goodness and kindness, and let us never forget this tragedy. Let it drive us and be the catalyst to finally eradicate the last vestiges of evil and darkness in the world, and let us say, Amen. Amen.